This episode of The Edge is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek.fm at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hi, I'm Rekha Sharma, and I played Landry on Star Trek Discovery. You are listening to The Edge on Trek FM.
What have you done out there on the edge of Federation space?
Welcome, listeners, to another episode of The Edge, Trek FM's dedicated podcast to Star Trek Discovery. I'm your host, Amy Nelson, and with me, as he is all the time, Patrick Devlin. Patrick, how are you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing great. It's been a wonderful day. It's only 170 degrees on my job and no air conditioning.
Oh, wait, are you working in Las Vegas? Because that's the temperature here.
I wish. No, I'm working at a hospital in Staten Island, and guess who's installing the ACs?
You. Oh.
So when we turn them on, guess who gets to leave and go to the next job without them?
Oh, man. You
this guy.
You don't even get to enjoy the spoils of your labor there.
Nope. Not at all. Oh. I'm doing better now, though. I mean, it's AC'd in my house, and we're talking Discovery, so.
Oh, it is. Very good. It's been a while since we've recorded together. Lots have happened, so we've been chit-chatting a little while, but I think ready.
STLV got in the way.
I know. And your vacation. And all kinds of stuff. Yeah.
So, but it's been,
Yeah. So now I'm back to work. I'm in teacher mode. I'm at my second week now, and I'm still underwater. I'm stressed beyond belief, but nice to have a break. Again, like I said, just talk Discovery.
Yep. Yeah. It's always better because tomorrow my life goes back to misery in that job. So at least we're here now.
Well, hey, Patrick, we got a wonderful email from a listener who had just listened to our short treks and I think has a very interesting perspective on the short treks and how they relate to Discovery, which was exactly what we were talking about in the Edge episode 76.
Awesome. So let's hear it.
All right. So this is from Robert. He says, "Hello, Amy and Patrick. I just listened to episode 76 about the short treks. I thought I might have a fairly unique perspective, at least among you, your listeners, to share. I did not watch or was even aware of the short treks until after having finished season 2. Because the show is distributed through Netflix here, the short treks were listed on the sidebar and I never noticed them. After season 2, wanting more Star Trek in my life, I started listening to some podcasts, including yours, and quite quickly figured out that I had missed something important. I then went back and watched them all. So I thought I would let you know how I found the story of season 2 without the background of having seen the short treks." I think this is a great email. I'm interested. I almost wish had I watched season 2 and then gone back to see the short treks. It would have been different, huh?
Yeah, I assume so. I mean, we covered that in the episode too, that it'd have to be a little different. Because some things wouldn't really make sense.
Right. So Robert continues and says, "The most jarring thing that happened was when they, quote, introduced Poe. She was clearly a character that had some backstory, but we were not really given it. When this came up, I actually turned to my partner and asked if she remembered where we had met this character. But we figured it would be explained later and were able to catch up with the story just fine. I did not really notice any problem with the Kelpian biology while watching the season. I thought they were simply getting a bit more background to the species. Now, having seen The Brightest Star, I can see how they kind of shifted the species from prey to farmed, as you two discussed in the podcast. Not having seen Calypso before the season meant that the idea of Discovery going into the future did not cross my mind until the finale. So in some ways, that was more of a surprise to me than it might have been. So all in all, I think it would have been better if I had seen the short treks before season two, but I wanted to say that the writers did a pretty good job of not making it, quote, required, while still having them be important. I only felt lost during the season for a few seconds, and it was not a critical moment. Thanks for all the work you do. I really appreciate it, Robert.
That's a really good perspective, and I think we kind of said similar things when we were talking about it. I mean, we had seen them first, so it was hard to go back and decide, but we had said that you might miss the fact of Saru being a different, his biology being a little different and stuff if you hadn't seen them. And I think we put a little more emphasis on not knowing Poe than it really mattered to him and his partner, as he said. Because they said it was jarring, but then they kind of got over it and just moved on, right? So I think we put maybe a little too much importance on that. And I'm actually jealous that he didn't know they were going into the future.
Right. That's the coolest thing, as not even thinking about this big, humongous jump. You know, because we had Calypso. So that would have been so cool. I'm a little jealous, Robert.
Yeah, me too. I think part of the being so connected, one of the problems with that is that we do get too many spoilers. And that was one of them. That short treks may have been better if it played between season two and three.
Oh.
And then you say, oh, okay, so maybe them going into the future is going to eventually lead to this story, not, well, how are we going to get to the future to get to this story?
Yeah. Ooh, yeah. What if they had Calypso now, after?
Right.
Yeah.
Right, because it's still foreshadowing, right? Because we don't know if Calypso is real or not if we don't see Calypso, right? So it's still giving you like a teaser for later, but it seems like I would have rather not think about getting to the future for 13 episodes.
Yeah.
If I could have avoided it.
Well, Robert, we thank you so much for your email and allowing us to talk and share it with the other listeners. And listeners, if you want to send us an email, please do so. We just might read it on air.
Yeah, and Robert, thank you very much for tuning in when you wanted some more Star Trek. We really appreciate all of our listeners tuning into us each couple weeks when we come out.
Well, we are going to talk about the rise, the fall, the rise of Laurel. So excited, Patrick, you came up with this topic. I'm just so happy you did.
Well, I was sitting around, and it's funny because I was going to message you, what do you want to do? And then you messaged me first, what do you want to do? But I was thinking, well, Amy likes the Klingons, and I'm talking Klingons on the round table. Why don't we talk about the Klingons? And then I was like, well, what can we talk about the Klingons to season two? Because not much happened. But when you look at Laurel's arc, she has a rise, a fall, and another rise. So there's actually a lot to talk about if you go through both seasons and not just focus on
season two. Yeah, and we had wanted to do, you know, character episodes, development after the second, and definitely Laurel definitely has this major, like you said, up and down roller coaster. So we thought we would highlight it. And I am bringing in some notes that I got from Star Trek Las Vegas also.
Oh, see, that's cheating because I didn't have access.
No, I know. So I'm going to drop some knowledge on you.
Ever the teacher.
All right. Well, we meet Laurel, and she is a follower of T'Kuvma. Like, she's one of the people that's there, and she definitely is following T'Kuvma. So I feel like she's just one of many, that she hasn't really made her mark quite yet to T'Kuvma. What do you think about that?
No, I agree. I don't think I think she had no influence when T'Kuvma was around. She wasn't, at least to him, anything special at the time. She was just another body. You know, I don't mean that to sound disrespectful, but he's putting together an army and you need bodies. And that's one of the ones he took, you know, or has, or whatever terminology you want to use for that, along with all the other houses that he was able to get behind him.
And he was able to get, you know, people from every house, because that's when we learned there were 24. So there was representation from each house. And so Laurel is, you know, for House of Mokai, to represent that household. And T'Kuvma, I think, was very much trying to gather and unite the Klingons based on religion. Like, he was there going off of Kalesh, and, you know, so he was trying to unite by religion. How successful do you think that was?
Not, but I actually have a little bit of a problem with that, because I don't think he was uniting according to religion. I think he was using religion to unite the culture.
So you don't think he was a true believer?
I don't. That's not necessarily what I said either, but I don't think the main goal was for the Klingons themselves, their religion and their culture is heavily tied, so it's hard to separate them to begin with. However, we didn't hear about wanting to... The quote wasn't, you know, remain Kalesh. It was remain Klingon. And their definition of that includes this religion. And I feel like he was using this religion, much like any other cult leader would, to get his followers to get in line with his idea of remaining Klingon.
Well, I'm going to respectfully disagree, because I feel like Takuvma really understood Kalesh, and that he was... I really felt from him this believer, like he, the way that he spoke was very, like when you read, like say the King James version of the Bible, like it's very, the way that they, that it's written, you know, compared to the NIV version that's more conversational, right? Like the way that Takuvma spoke sort of led me to believe that he was truly, in his mind, believing that he was doing the best thing, that he was uniting based on this spirituality based off of Kalesh.
That might be true. I'm not necessarily knocking that idea from that point of view. However, it's hard, like I said, it's hard because their religion is so tied to their culture that it's really... more of the culture than the religion itself anyway. However, so that point may be true, that he does really believe, but at the same point, so did David Koresh. If you listen to him, that's how he got so many followers. You know, they didn't stand up against the FBI at Waco, Texas, simply because they didn't believe he knew what he was talking about with the Bible. I don't think Takuvma was necessarily bad, like David Koresh was. Don't get me... I'm not comparing the two morally. I'm just saying, I think they used religion for their ends.
So, yeah. So the big picture was that Takuvma is using, or I mean, yes, he is using religion to try and unite the Klingon Empire.
Right. And I don't know if the religion was the end game for him, even if it's something he really believes in. You know what I'm saying? Like, that, it's really... It's such a subtle difference from what you said that I probably shouldn't have brought it up, but here we are. you know, because the listener now thinks I just completely disagree with you, and that's not the case. The case, it's a slight difference, but I just think it mattered more about being Klingon than the religion of being Klingon.
Yeah.
To a slight degree. And if that... If he could have gotten it and he had to change the religion, I feel he would have if it meant that the Klingons would stay
right
together.
So it's interesting you bring up, what is the end game? Like, what is the result that we're trying? And you're right. I do believe that Takuvma wanted a united Klingon empire and was using religion. But I do believe that Takuvma was a true believer and felt that the religion could do that as a consequence of everyone believing.
I agree with you. I agree with that completely. I just think that, and this is such semantics, but if he had found out that 20 houses would join if they abandoned the religion, he would have abandoned the religion to keep the 20 houses.
Okay. So that's where I think we disagree, okay.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's the difference. But so if he had to abandon the religion to keep the empire together, he would have done that over letting the empire dissolve to keep a small set of followers of the religion.
Okay, so no, I don't agree with that, because when...
And so much for Laurel.
I know. We'll get to Laurel. We promise. We've got a lot to discuss. But, I mean, even when he was, you know, speaking his, you know, weird language and stuff all in Klingon, which was still really cool. I really liked that Discovery took that chance, just throwing that in there. But even when he was talking and like people were, especially Cole was like, well, sort of, you know, coming up against him, he's like, no, we will remain Klingon and this is the way. And I just feel like he was so passionate that the religion was what's going to save the Klingon. It wasn't going to be something else. It was through Kalish.
I can't disagree with that. I think I could have seen it going a different way, is all I'm saying. Again, though, it's hard because the Klingon culture is so tied to the Klingon religion. It's not like here in America where, hey, I'm Catholic, but I've been to church times in my life. You know what I mean? So it's just too ingrained in the culture. So you really can't have one without the other, if that makes sense. So again, everything I'm saying is hypothetical here. And it's fairly useless, except we have to podcast about something.
So with Takuvma, he does name a torchbearer, and that is Voke. Because Voke, I think, again, truly is this believer. I mean, he puts his hand in fire, and he's like, you know, I was an outcast. I'm this albino Klingon. I do not have a house. I'm a house of none. And Takuvma welcomes him, embraces him, and names him the torchbearer. And when Takuvma dies, is killed, then Voke now, and this is where Laurel steps up and supports Voke and says, he is the torchbearer. He needs to be the one to lead us. So she's taking this action where she's now rising above where she was a nobody before, but now she's rising.
Yes. So it's a risk to take the albino, right? I mean, because he's mocked by everyone. However, Takuvma felt he was mocked by everyone. Remember, they wanted to play in his dad's ship and all that. So he kind of saw a little bit of himself in Voke. In doing so, he didn't intentionally raise Laurel's station because he didn't really know who Laurel was still. But unintentionally, the consequence was that eventually when he died, that Laurel's station in the hierarchy was raised. But not really, because Voke was kind of looked at as a joke by the rest of the Klingons anyway, once Takuvma died. She was steadfast, though, in saying that he's the torchbearer according to Takuvma, so he's my torchbearer.
So that begs the question, like, do you believe that Laurel truly was a believer of Takuvma and Kalish? Or do you think she is, at this point, when she supports Voke, is being opportunist?
Well, I think you can be both.
Okay.
I think you can really believe in them and also realize, here's an opportunity for me. And I think that in the beginning, that might have been where it was leading, but it very quickly dissipates into she's still a true believer, but Voke's never getting over. Sorry for listeners who don't understand what I just said, in over. In wrestling terms, that means the fans care about you.
Thank you for the translation. Google Translate.
I still have a look. So if people are buying into your story or something like that in wrestling, or they're cheering for you, that's getting over, right? They want to see you. If you're a bad guy, obviously it's if they're booing for you, but whatever. So I think she realized real quick that this wasn't going to work because the other houses didn't care about an albino Voke. And she became opportunistic again when they offered the rest of his crew food and they took it. And she took the food and handed him over.
Yeah, so it's interesting because I think you're right. I think that she was in the beginning a believer. Otherwise, she wouldn't have come to Takuvma. She wouldn't have represented her entire house of Mos Kai. And that she wouldn't have... I mean, I don't know, maybe supporting Voke was opportunistic, but then it's like, which horse are you going to back? Are you going to back the albino, or are you going to back Cole, who has obviously major strength and support, and she chooses to support Voke? So there is that slight question. You're right. Maybe she does see both, that she is, and I think starts out to be maybe a true believer, and sort of backs the wrong horse-ish.
Yeah. Oh, right. Or, I mean, so you can be both. I mean, it's not really a 50-50 thing. You can be 100-100. You can be 100% opportunistic and 100% true believer. And I think that's where she fits. I think she backs Volk initially because he was tapped by Takuma. And initially she thought that that would mean something, but it meant nothing to the Klingons. Yeah. It meant once Takuma was dead, it meant nothing. Mm-hmm. So now she's already stuck in this situation. She can't. I guess they could have written it that she just immediately backtracked on that, but that would be stupid, right? I mean, would you buy it? I wouldn't. So they have her back him till the moment she can't any longer. And she's now she it looks like she's turning on him, but we know now, you know, she didn't really turn on him. She found a way to keep him alive in while looking like she was getting rid of him.
I know, which makes me wonder, was she able to recognize the strategy that she needed to pull this off? Like, I wonder how intelligent and, you know, smart she was to pull this off.
So I think she understood that if she was, again, here's the opportunistic
right.
part. And there might be some part of this that where she's a true believer, but she realized that she would never on her own, with no allies and just working under Cole, be able to
under Volk?
Bring no under oh, okay. Cole. No, so by herself with no allies under Cole, she would never be able to get back to Kuvma's message. That wouldn't happen. Cole wouldn't allow it. You know, but so she needed Volk as the face because we've talked about this in the podcast. She's way better in the behind the scenes anyway. Right. It's unlikely in the society that the Klingons have presented to us that a woman would get over in the first mm-hmm. place and be the leader, right? So the fact that that eventually happens is crazy, but there's, of course, they give her a special key to becoming chancellor. You know, they don't just let her become it because it wouldn't make sense continuity-wise with the way that culture is presented mm-hmm. to us. So she knew she needed a face, and it couldn't be hers. So if she lets if Volk just goes or worse she dies with him that serves no purpose. So she has to get him out of there. I don't think at that time she knew how she was going to get him back because obviously that plan didn't work. That actually falls apart. But she knew she had to get rid of him so that they believed he was dead, so she can continue to work until she could find a way to bring him back and take back the Klingon Empire.
So it's at this time where, you know, her and Volk, they couple together. Shall we remove the coupling together? That was my Laurel voice, if you didn't know.
It was so cheesy when it aired.
I loved it. Oh, my gosh.
I just didn't like it. It was just cheesy.
Yeah, but you got the message loud and clear, right?
Yeah, I guess.
So, yes. Now, Volk, obviously, with no support, he only has a small portion of those who, you know, believe that he is the torchbearer. Again, I think he get these followers because of the religion aspect. I don't think it was any, like, characteristics that he possessed that brought them to it. I think it was because he was named torchbearer. Okay.
I completely agree. Which, by the way, he's the second torchbearer, so he's the second choice.
Right, yes.
We're all following the second option here, by the way.
Yes, but, that's true. Yeah.
But he loses all of them when they don't have food.
Right.
Because here's the bottom line. If I can't eat, I can't worry about anything else.
Because
doesn't matter how much I believe in you. If I can't feed myself, that's an irrelevant fact.
And so, yeah, after Takuvma dies, like, Volk stays. And Cole leaves, takes all of the followers, except the few, you know, couple dozen. And yes, they end up starving and cannibalism.
Sitting on a ship for months.
Yeah. Not good. Not good.
No.
Not good. So this would be a definite fall for Laurel. She backed the wrong horse.
Right, and even in this fall, this one's not even the major fall of the first season. Because in now switching sides, right, when she grabs the chicken wing or whatever, turkey leg or whatever she grabs, I think turkey leg.
Giorgio.
Probably some other animal. What?
Giorgio.
No, that wasn't Giorgio's body at that point.
Okay.
Okay, maybe it was. No, that's months later. It'd be gross to eat a human that's been dead for months. I'm not even worried about the eating the human part in this statement, but whatever. Anyway, when she grabs a body part of something and eats it, right, she ends up getting a prisoner ship to captain.
Oh, you mean when Cole comes in and gives them food?
Yes.
Oh, okay. All right. Yes, that's some kind of animal. Yeah, we're fine.
Right, yeah. So, but it looks like a turkey leg when she grabs it. You know what I mean?
Right,
like,
yeah.
So, but at that point, she actually doesn't fall that far. She's doing better off with Cole than she is with Volk, because now she, at least she has a ship where there's food on it.
Yeah, that's true. So she does save herself by aligning with Cole. So now she's on her way coming back up. But I mean, that was a pretty scary fall to be in a position where you have no food, no escape, no allies, nothing.
Yeah, no, I agree. I just don't, I guess I don't attribute that to her, because I attribute that to Volk.
Yes, I agree.
So,
but she backed
she's still
him,
on this roller coaster.
So,
yeah. You're right. So technically, yeah, she obviously nosedives with him. I just kind of gloss over that because I pick her story up from the prisoner ship on.
Yeah.
In terms of moving up, because now, so yeah, so we've already had one dip, mm-hmm. right? Now she comes back up to be a prisoner ship. And
so Cole, she's supposed to, yeah, but explain that a little better. So Cole says, well, you were important. You were, you know, you obviously are a believer. Now, I don't believe Cole is trying to unite the kingdom on religion at all.
No, but he's trying to get, I believe he's trying to get Volk's followers to follow Laurel.
By bringing her on, then those followers will come on.
Follow her, and if she follows him, then they all follow him.
Smart, smart, yeah.
You know, if she was number two, right, and they get rid of number one, but she's still around, so now we also have this 20 other people, right, who used to follow Volk. They're not going to want to follow Cole, so right. He'll always have to worry in the back of his mind, when are they going to try and come after yep. me? But if I bring their number two on and make them someone important, I only have to watch number two. And when they come after me, I have to worry about the other 20.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So Cole sort of tests her and says, if you're going to follow me, you better get rid of Volk and you better kill him.
Right. And that's when she comes up with the plan to leave him on Giorgio's ship.
Yes, and to...
On the Shenzo.
Yes, and have her house, Mokai, go to the female women of Mokai. The mothers
right.
of
Mokai. How convenient that, yeah. by the way, Cole decides, you should do this, and I'm going to leave and not watch you.
Yeah. I thought that was... Well, now, I think that's very interesting, because he should be spying on her to see... I mean, it's a test of loyalty. Are you just going to take her word for it? If you're testing her loyalty,
he's beamed over there. He's like, I can't believe she did this to me. I trusted in her and I loved her and blah blah blah. I mean, he didn't say all those things on screen, but you know that's what's going on in his head. Mm-hmm. And then she beams over like 30 seconds later and is like, shh, I have a plan.
Mm-hmm.
And then we don't hear about the plan for a while. But I mean, so he didn't scan for transporter beams. It should only be one.
Yeah,
it shouldn't be three.
Yeah. So Cole definitely does test Laurel, but apparently
he's terrible at it.
Yes, but he believes that Volk is now dead. And so I think because of that test, he rewards her by giving her her own prison ship. And so now she's captain of this prison ship, which how high do you think that is?
In a war? Pretty high.
Is it? Okay.
I mean, look, it depends on what armies and militaries and countries you're looking at, but a lot of high-ranking officials and a lot of the Nazi Party, for one, you know, would give that you know, the concentration camps to people that they highly valued.
Oh, that's true, it was yeah.
kind of an easy job for them. I mean, I'm not trying – I get it. The Klingons are not portrayed as Nazis here.
Right.
But they are exhibiting some of those characteristics that it should be Klingons and only Klingons. The biggest reason for this war is when they say they come in peace, they're trying to assimilate us to them and we don't want to be them.
Yeah.
Right. We want to be us and we're better because we're perfect because we're Klingon. So It is some, I don't think it's the highest of high positions, don't get me wrong, but I think it is a semi-high position for a culture that goes to war and believes in war. I would assume if you read back Chinese history or Genghis Khan, that higher members would end up with these types of positions as well, because it was an easier job, you know, just watching a being the head of a prison than it was actually out on the battlefield. And I also think part of it is, you know, how much damage can you do from a prison ship? Because we're really only putting humans in there, and you don't like them either.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you like me or not is irrelevant. You're never going to work with them.
So Cole, we can definitely agree, is trying to unite the kingdom based off of his iron fist and fear. Like, he's a dictator.
Oh, no, he's an absolute lunatic. Yeah. Yes.
So, yeah, this.
I don't even know if he needs all of them. Like, I don't even know if he cares if he gets all 24 houses.
Right. Just as long as it's majority or that he has power.
He'll make a play for them, but if he gets 20, he's cool.
Yeah.
I can cause a lot of problems with 20 houses.
Yeah.
18 houses, you know?
Yeah. It's definitely the fear, because he definitely tries to intimidate Laurel, you know, getting in her face. And, you know, there's definite intimidation there. And he's just ruling with this fear and reward. You did this, now I'm going to reward you. Like, it's very interesting to look
his
at.
His whole methodology is consequences, negative and positive consequences to actions.
Yes. So she's now a commander of her own ship under Cole. And then we get to see Cornwell.
The next fall.
Yes, the next
the
fall.
The next fall coming.
Yeah.
Yeah, so she's basically told to interrogate Cornwell, and that's an awesome scene where they're screaming at each other, where she says to scream, and then she screams, and Cornwell screams, and everyone screams, and then Cornwell appears dead at the end, but we find out, nope, and she gets caught.
Yeah. Cole's not happy. How did she escape death? I forget.
I don't. Did they give us an actual answer as to how she didn't die?
I mean, because Cole should have killed her.
Because we had season two written partly already.
Okay.
I mean, it's just bad. People don't want me to be negative. I'm not allowed to be negative anymore.
Oh,
I can't say anything about that. All right, fine. I'll be negative. Because it was poorly written. That's why. Because any other time in history, it would have been this whole 30-minute speech about honor and the murder of Laurel. They would have chased her to the end of the universe for that.
Yeah, I think Cole definitely would, especially with his fear and reward tactics and how he is this dictator.
Well, look, if your whole purpose is to run your empire by making people fear you.
You can't let people live. So Cole does, So Laurel does escape, and she, where is she at this time? During the mirror universe, we don't really know exactly where she's at.
She ends up back on the Discovery at some point, trapped, right? I mean, she gets arrested on the Discovery.
See, that's why I think the Discovery rescued her. They did.
And put her in a prison?
Yes.
I don't know. Listeners, let us know how the heck she got out of there and got back on the Discovery, because they arrested her at some point and they put her in a brig.
Yes.
And because if she's not in the brig, she can't try and save Tyler, who doesn't get saved.
Yes. So she is in the brig. We're picking this back up after Mir. Yes.
So season one, this is the bottom. This is the lowest she's been in season
one. Yes. Because now she's.
This is actually worse than no food.
Exiled from the Klingon nation, like gone.
And not even that. She's also a prisoner to her enemy. It's not even like she's just, look, you got exiled. That sucks. But you go live on Andoria and it's all right. Well, that's cold. But you get my point.
Yeah.
It's terrible. However, not only is she exiled, she goes back to the people, or she somehow finds her way back to the people who she was the enemy with. Because remember, she did help Cornwell. So that might have played some role in this, because I don't remember at all. And you're right. I should have watched. But they put her in the brig. You can't be any lower, especially for a Klingon.
Yeah.
Being a prisoner is not honorable.
No.
It's more honorable to be dead.
To die in battle. Yep, exactly. Yep. Yeah. So this is, yes, I would agree with you. I sort of thought the first was lower, but this is definitely lower.
No, the first sucks because you don't have any food. Yeah. But when you take their culture into context, it would have been better to die of starvation.
Right.
Standing up for your beliefs than it would be to be in a brig with the stuff.
Being held prison. Yeah. Many times I heard Worf talk about, oh, the Romulans took them prisoner. They should have died.
Yep. Yeah. It's probably the lowest she gets through the first two seasons. Although season two, she gets pretty low, but this is the worst.
So she's in the brig. That gives the opportunity to, at the end of season one, to reclaim and rise again from her lows of her lows.
Like the proverbial phoenix.
Yes.
Which is handed to her because Michael doesn't want to blow up the planet.
Right.
I mean, this is what it comes down to. It comes down to they go there to put a bomb in the planet. And when they realize this, they come up with a new plan. One that doesn't murder millions of Klingons.
So it's interesting that now she has this bomb and she's using it as a threat to her entire planet. You better follow me or else. Like, that is a very interesting, I mean, she's not uniting them around religion. She's, I don't even think this is an iron fist. This is a demand that you will, I mean, she's holding him ransom.
No, this is Cole to an extreme.
Yes.
This is an extreme, this is Cole sitting back going, oh man, I wish I would have thought of that.
Exactly. Yes. Cole was thinking that. Oh, how come that didn't fall into my lap?
Right. Man, if only I would have thought of that one. You know, I mean, this is an extreme. You have to listen to me or I'm blowing up our planet.
We get Laurel with the bomb. She unites the Klingon Empire by force. They all agree to stop warring with each other. And they all agree that they are going to now support Laurel. Their arms are twisted. There's no choice.
Yeah, they have no choice.
Right.
And this would be the highest point of season one for her.
It's a very... it's not the... Oh, for season one, yes. But it's not the highest.
For season one.
Yeah.
The highest point for season one.
Yeah.
In the season one arc, this is the highest. It's a morally low point.
Yes.
However,
yes.
It is... In terms of where she is in society, you can't get much higher,
right?
For her society, I mean, she'd have to become Kalesh in order to be higher than what she is now. So,
yeah, you're right. It is a very morally low point for her.
Oh, extremely. Here, if you don't listen to me, I'm going to kill your families and your babies.
Yeah, but she does with that power. Can you transform that into something good? Because in season two, now that everyone's following her, and again, the timing on this does not make sense because I would think that she would need time to get the Klingons to trust her, and we don't get that in between the seasons as much as I feel is necessary for her story. But we will just pretend that she has been dealing with these Klingons. And I think what gets to her pinnacle, to her absolute highest, is when she now pronounces, "We are united and you can call me mother." She's uniting the Klingon kingdom behind family. She calls the Klingon cruiser, her offspring. Like, even the language that she's using is this family orientation. And it's like, you know what? Being united around religion didn't work. Being united with an iron fist and a dictator and me threatening to blow your brains out with this bomb didn't work. Let's try uniting around being a family. And I think that is her pinnacle. That's her high point. Don't rain on my parade. Go for it. I've got my umbrella up.
No, I mean, I don't totally disagree. I just, Yeah, that's great that she uses the word mother, but she has visible detractors still. I mean, there's still people who are against her. They go and kidnap her kid at one point, right? Mm-hmm. Because when she used the word mother, we don't know she actually has a kid yet, right? I think that's right. The order it goes in. And but when we find out she has a kid, they kidnap the kid.
And but that was her uncle. Because
her own family.
The uncle was trying to protect her. Keep that in mind.
Yeah, I've heard that before. However, while she's saying "I'm call me mother," she still has a bomb under their planet. I mean, it's not like she was like, "Look, click, it's off. Call me mother," and they didn't riot. She's like, "Look, here's a bomb. Call me mom." That's my problem with it.
Yeah, I know.
There's no way to get out of the moral issue of the bomb because it's still there at this moment in the storyline.
So, yeah, that's my question.
It hasn't gone away.
Do you think that you can, if you start being this iron fist and this ruling by fear, can you ever turn that?
No, I don't think so. I think history would say no one's ever done it well, at least. So whether it can be done, I don't believe so, because you've made too many enemies to ever ease up. You could, so one of your enemies are eventually going to take you out. Mm-hmm. It's just the nature of holding a bomb to people's heads, quite literally.
Yeah. So, you know, a couple of podcasts ago, we talked about leadership styles. And this sort of is bringing to mind again, because you always look at Star Trek and how it relates to your life. So when I have been told many times that when kids first meet me, and this usually happens at the end of the year, and they're like, "Miss Nelson, I was so scared of you at the beginning, the first few weeks and months. I didn't want to say anything. I was just so scared and I thought you were so mean. And now you're my favorite teacher," and blah, blah, blah. So I look at that and I'm like, okay, should I, and this is just me and my self-reflection, should I start softer so that the kids don't feel so intimidated? Because in the end, my kids tell me about their lives. Like, I love them like my own. They know it. Like, it's a big love fest at the end of the year. But at the beginning of the year, I have a lot of kids who are seriously intimidated by me. So somehow I'm able to change that. And I know I'm not holding a bomb to their head. But I mean,
okay, so I was about to say, you are comparing yourself to genocide at the moment.
No.
I mean, at no point do I think you start to clap, and maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think you walk around beating them in the head with books.
Now listen, if they don't pass math, they're not getting a high school diploma.
I understand that, but you're not the one beating them over the head with a book, quite literally. Well, if you started off the class, you know, with the broomstick and whacking them every time they got a question wrong, you could never stop that. Because if you tried to soften, they would eat you alive.
Yeah.
As a teacher, you can't be soft up front, overly soft, because they will eat you alive. Mm-hmm. But a lot of that, again, a lot of the reason why you can't be soft up front is because they've had really hard, bad teachers. I don't mean that they don't know how to teach, although there's some of them too. Mm-hmm. But they've had teachers who are just overbearing the whole time and believe that every kid is trying to get over with every statement they make. And if they find a teacher who's really lax, they're going to take a mile. You know, one of the things I learned, and I learned this in high school, my dean actually said it to me, and I was amazed at the statement and didn't understand it when I was a kid, but I do now. He said, "You know why people in I went to St. Mary's. He goes, "You know why we have a better graduation from college rate than Chaminade does?" And Chaminade had a better acceptance rate into better colleges.
Yeah.
You know, Ivy League and stuff. They go, "The reason is because I let you make mistakes and punish you for them."
Mm.
In Chaminade, you're never even allowed to make the mistake in the first place. They're so overbearing at all times that when many of their students get out into the real world, they no longer know how to act. They can't sustain that type of learning and drive because they've been overburdened by helicopter teachers. I don't know any other better term. And helicopter administrators, you know, that they've never been given a chance to make a mistake and learn from those mistakes. So when you have teachers that are like that, I've had a few. Mm-hmm. When you get the next one who's really, really lax up front, man, you walk all over that guy.
Right, right.
You know, but if you come in hard, well, I teach too, so yeah. I get it. I'm strict. I'm much more strict in the beginning of the semester than I am at the end of this.
Exactly.
You can slide with more things at the end. Mm-hmm. First off, for two reasons. One, I've gotten most of the information I need you to get out of the way. Mm-hmm. So now there's more time. I need to make sure I get that information to you. And then once there is, now I can figure out, I don't really only have one class left, but there's three classes to go. If they want to talk a little, we can BS a little. You know, but... And another reason is because I need them to know that in this room, I'm the boss. And if we're going to be friends later, friends, air quotes, yeah. You know, friendly. When I say no and stop, that means we're stopping. That's it. We're back to teacher mode.
Yeah.
So, but again, it is, yes, I get what you're saying, but the comparison is kind of ridiculous. You're comparing blowing up a planet to sit down and stop talking. Don't chew gum.
That's right. That is my number one rule.
I know. I found that out
on a round table. Yes.
Yep. We talked about that on my round table.
Sidebar, there were two people chewing gum on the STLV panels. I could not believe it. And it was Jonathan Frakes. Sorry to call him out, but Miss Nelson is talking. If you are on stage, you are not chewing gum.
So how many people do you think were in that room with you watching that panel?
I'm going to say maybe 300.
Oh, then you're the only person who noticed that.
No, because I told everyone around me.
You might have told them, but you're the only one who noticed.
Oh,
if it was like 1,000, maybe there was another teacher.
You're going to...
Unlikely. Yeah.
You're going to love this. Mary Wiseman, who plays Tilly, she was chewing gum. Oh, and she...
That's it! I cannot stand people who chew gum. No, actually, I really like Mary Wiseman. I just don't like
gum. I know. Those were the two people on stage. Okay, let's get back to Laurel. That so annoyed me. Oh, my gosh.
But that's my point. You see how annoyed you are by gum chewing? Laurel would have blown up the planet for that.
No, she wouldn't.
If she was you, she would have. That's the difference. Your classes make it to the end, even though I'm sure some try to chew gum.
Yes. So I find that transition that she tries to make, and I wonder if her being mother is a successful translation. Do you think
it's easy with a bomb?
Right.
That's the problem. The problem is, and like I said, the big problem with changing this morally is, to this day, if this was real, the bomb is still there under her control, right? So everything else she does is kind of semantics.
Yeah.
To the bomb. She's mother. Yep, she's mother. All right, mother.
Yeah.
Thanks, mother. Cool, mother. Let me get a hold of that bomb. You'll stop being mother.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, that sort of ruins Laurel for me now that we are talking
I know
about
they,
it.
Well, they try to portray it the way you believe.
Yeah, but it's
but
not.
But the truth is the bomb's there.
Yeah, it isn't. Yeah. So
I actually like her for it, by the way. I'm exactly the opposite of you. The fact that she has the guts to be like, I'll blow all of y'all up, mess with me one time, is why I like her so much.
Okay, let's be realistic.
Her house goes too. She's got just as much skin in that.
There's only so much that she can use, so much power that she can use from that. Because if she uses it too much, it's the boy who cried wolf. I'm right. If you don't follow me, if you don't build my cruiser, if you don't support me 100%, I'm going to blow you up. You can't use that over and over again.
As long as they're still actually doing it, she can.
Well, then that would depend on her convincibility.
Correct. But to my knowledge, nobody ever was like, no.
Yeah.
The first time someone says no and she doesn't blow it up, it's like, huh, here she goes again.
Yeah.
But to this point, everyone's done everything she said.
Yeah, that's true.
So no one even tested the theory.
That's true.
So she could use that until the first time someone tests her.
Yeah. I'm just used to kids testing me.
I know, but they don't have a bomb in the planet either. see, nobody in this story is actually Laurel because nobody actually can blow up Earth.
Mm-hmm. Thank goodness.
No, and you're right, though. Like, in the relationship you're talking about, teacher, student, parent, child, if I keep yelling, if you don't stop, I'm going to punish you, and don't punish them, yep, the statement is worthless.
Oh, my gosh, you know, yes.
My son just waits to hear it, act like he cares, and then go back to doing whatever he wanted to do. That's how children are, you know? I punish him, and he still just waits to go back to doing whatever he was doing. But, you know, if I really wasn't punishing him, then he would never care about the statement at all.
Exactly.
However, if I said, I'm going to throw your computer out the window if you don't stop, and then I took his computer and threw it out the window, guess what would happen the next time I said that statement?
Yep. True.
Now, usually he stops trying to not find out whether I'm going to throw the computer out the window or not. So as long as he keeps stopping, I can keep threatening the computer.
Yeah. I need parents to get there where you are. Like, if you make a threat, first of all, teacher rule number one, if you make a threat, you better follow through with it, because you will have a student that's going to test it. And I'm sure with kids, have enough kids, there's going to be one of them that's going to test you to the limits.
Yeah. Look, if you're a parent, you just need one to find that point.
I mean, very compliant as a kid. My mom, she would do the countdown, 3, 2, at 2. I was scared out of my wits. She never got to 1. My brother,
it's always 2.
Got to 1.
It's always 2. It's always 2.
Two is scary.
No matter what number you start on. It's not, no matter what number you, I've started on 3, I've started on 5, 2 stops everything. Yes. I'm just going to start at 2 from now on. 2! There we go. but like, okay, but that's great. As long as they never make me get to 1 and I don't do what I promised, I can keep doing that without ever fearing actually having to do what I said. Now,
but
I can't make ridiculous
you.
Claims.
Yeah.
But if the first time they cut me, I go down to 0 and I go, oh, crap.
I know. Now you have to do it. And so help me, parents. If you don't do it, you are upsetting all of the teachers in this entire world. And that means me.
But there's a lot of that. There is a lot of that. However, we've never seen on screen, and we've never been hinted to, the fact that someone did test Laurel, and she was like, "I'll do it. I'm gonna. We want to talk about it."
Yeah. I mean, because it doesn't even make sense for her to use it, because then she would lose everything as well. It doesn't.
She would, but is she crazy enough to do that? Do you want to be the one to test that theory? Do you want to be in a starship somewhere like, by the way, Cole, yeah, planet's gone. I didn't listen. Guess we found out the answer to that question. You don't want to be that guy.
It's sticky. I think you're right. It's a low, but is trying to be portrayed as a high and trying to get it spun as this good thing of mother.
You know, and I also think she has the best of intentions. I don't think her intentions are negative. I think that the culture and the fact that, you know, she backed a horse with no legs in a race put her in a position where she needs something insane to get her, to get to this point. But it's a morally wrong choice. I mean,
it is. So then is everything that she does after tainted?
It is, but... And I'll say this like it was said on the roundtable. It's a morally wrong choice for humans. They're not human.
I don't know how I feel about that.
No, and so I think in this scenario, it's pretty clear to say that, okay, I'm human, so I see it through a human lens, and I think I'm right because you're going to blow up a planet. You know, but there, if you scale that down a bit, cultural differences should be respected, right?
Agreed.
Well, this is a cultural difference, but we're talking about a planet now. And we're talking about genocide, so it gets a little out of hand with just going, well, that's their culture, so okay. You know, like, that's the problem.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that their culture is different, but still killing everyone, like, that's an absolute.
No, I understand. Yeah. I just don't think that the rest of the Klingon Empire would agree that it's morally wrong or shouldn't be done. Is my only point. I agree they'd all be really mad, but that doesn't mean they believe it's morally correct.
Okay, I see the distinction. Yeah. Yeah, that could be. We just don't know enough about them.
And I think that me being a human, looking through a human lens, I think when we talk genocide, I don't care what your culture believes. I think it's wrong. Mm-hmm. If, for instance, I don't hit my kids, but if your culture spanks them and it's not out of control, that's your culture, that you do what you want. I mean, I'm not talking about breaking bones and cracking skulls, but, you know, that is what it is. If your culture is to murder people for taking a cookie, we have a problem, regardless of the fact that that's your culture. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. You have to draw a line somewhere.
So it's hard because you are talking about different cultures. Yeah. You know, and again, it gets even more confusing when you dive even deeper into this, because really the Klingons are just a reflection of different human traits.
Yes, you know? It is. I was going to mention that. Like, it all comes back because this is who we are. I know.
So it gets even more confusing at that point. But if we just take it on the surface, I don't know that the Klingons would agree with me. It's a morally wrong choice. Mm-hmm. You know, so.
Yeah. So did you want to talk about her return?
We touched on it, but her low of season two is when the baby is kidnapped, right? Because now essentially she's being held hostage over holding the world hostage because she has a bomb. Right? So someone else is now controlling her actions, which then control,
yes,
in turn control the bomb.
Yeah. Indirectly.
Yes. Right.
You do what I say because I have your baby, therefore I control the bomb.
Correct.
Yeah.
Now, so that would be her low of season two. We find out that they take the baby, and when they finally get it back, and she ends up killing the uncle, right, and his people.
And how awesome is that? That it's like, oh, you think this baby means something to me? The Klingons mean more. I'm going to kill the baby. I'm going to kill Voke, Tyler. You have no power over me. Right. She totally reclaims that.
Yeah, well, that's what I was getting to. So she kills the uncle, right? And the way they presented the scenes was awesome, because you thought she was talking to the rest of the Klingon Empire about her traitorous uncle until you see Voke's head.
Yes.
Being thrown into the pit.
I know.
You know, the way she was talking was about a traitor, and it was about, you know, someone who would was going to screw up the Empire and blah, blah, blah. And then you were like, oh, that's the baby.
Yeah.
That's Voke. Ooh. And then you find out, no, it's not.
Yeah.
You know, the baby is now in, they don't tell you at that point, but you find out later that he's in the time crystal cave.
Yes. Thing.
And that Voke is, you know, Section 31.
Yeah, Tyler.
So now, once again, though, they wrote this in a way that kind of annoys me. The only way Laurel ends up in power in both seasons is by Section 31 or Starfleet. Section 31 comes up with a plan to put the baby there and to take in Tyler. Section 31, it's hinted that Section 31 had a part of her original getting the bomb, even though it wasn't, because that cutaway scene at the end that we saw later, Section 31 was on the planet at least.
Right.
So it's kind of, you could, maybe it's not kind of, you could believe that the bomb was placed in that position by Section 31 in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah. I could see that easily.
Right. I mean, I don't think they directly said, oh, give it to Laurel, so that's not what I mean. I think they influenced the fact that bomb would get there, yes, and be on the planet.
Hmm.
And then indirectly, when they found out that this is what was happening, they turned, you know, Michael and Tilly turned it over to Laurel. And that's why we have the scene where Georgiou becomes Section 31. Also, they just wanted to get Laurel, Georgiou into Section 31, but... Remember he puts down the communicator badge and kind of walks away.
That deleted
scene. So to me that kind of hints at the fact that they were more involved. You could take out of that if you wanted to, that they were more involved through season one than was shown.
Yep. I agree with you there. And definitely after seeing season two and
And they're heavily involved.
Yep.
You know, because now they have Tyler, so as part of their ranks. So, but again, maybe I would have liked to have seen in the first two seasons. Oh, we did that in Final Thoughts, but.
Yeah, no,
so
we're
that's how
we're
she gets good. Her power. Okay. So my final thoughts really on the whole thing is I just kind of wish that one time she rose to power, it would have been her own doing. At no point ever was it her own doing. When she rises with Volk, it's because Takuvma was killed by Georgiou and Michael, right? So she kind of just went along for the ride. It's not, you know, she was there. She wasn't an important part to that point. She becomes important because she has Volk's back and Volk falls in love with her. But then the next time she really rises to power is because the Federation gives her a bomb. And then the next time it's because Section 31 steps in and helps her get rid of the evidence.
Yeah, the Federation is all in their business.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, look, they set up that Section 31 does these kind of things in Enterprise when they made sure that the Klingons got a hold of Phlox to fix the disease, to explain to us the stupid forehead ridges that didn't need to get explained.
Right.
But that set up the fact that they meddle in these things to make sure that certain world leaders end up in certain places.
I mean,
David Ward, I think it was, wrote the books on them.
Dayton Ward.
Section 31. Dayton Ward. Sorry. It's late. But so we had, was he the one we had on Warp 5?
Yeah. Right?
So he came on and said that none of this is how Section 31 was supposed to be. However, in Enterprise and Discovery, this is how they're portrayed.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it does set up, I mean, if you look into TNG, where you have got Picard, you know, sort of going through, and when Kim Peck is poisoned and helps become, and who's going to decide? Is it going to be Doros or Gowron, right? And so they have to go through the arbitrator and stuff like that. So the Federation definitely is very interested in the politics of the Klingon Empire.
Oh, absolutely. And they should be.
Yes.
But my point is that Section 31 is directly influencing it from behind the scenes, whereas Picard was asked to do it because he's a respected person.
Because Kempek asked him.
Right. There's a distinct difference. They picked him because they knew he would be fair as an arbiter. He wasn't thrust upon them by some shadowy organization.
Right. Yeah. No, so my final thoughts have now changed. I had my final thoughts, but the whole idea of mother is now tainted for me. But my final thoughts were that, you know, we've seen through the two seasons that they're trying to unite the Klingon Empire. And we get Takuvma, who's trying to unite the Klingon Empire through religion. And that didn't work out. And then we have Cole, who's trying to unite the Klingon Empire by using this fear and reward, this iron fist, do as I say. And that didn't work. But then yet, Laurel comes in, does it even better with an iron fist with Laurel, but then twists it to say, oh, now we're one big happy family, and is using family to unite the Klingon Empire, which may work for the followers and like the lowers, if you will. But in her higher council, in her the high council, like it probably and most definitely is through the iron fist and through fear and intimidation. Like, you better do what I say. I'm going to destroy you if you don't. Type of thing. And that sort of taints it, because I really wanted her to be mother. I wanted her to envelop the Klingons and to get them, you know, the one big happy family. But it's not that way. And it's interesting for me to think about that I wanted it that way, but it's not. And like that dichotomy between the two.
Well, what's even more interesting is they wanted you to believe it that way too.
Yeah.
And because you want to believe it that way, you did. You know, they played on the fact that most people are not nearly as cynical as I am and wouldn't think of the bomb. They would think of the mother statement, and they could just bypass the whole bomb issue and just ignore it.
Right.
But the truth is, they didn't tell me it's gone, so it's not.
Yeah.
And what's also interesting is Cole would have worked fine had the Federation not given her a better stick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had a big stick to beat people with, but she got a much bigger
one. Yeah. And so that was her rise to power.
Yep.
Well, it's been fun talking about the rise, the fall, and the rise of Laurel today. But this isn't the only thing we've been discussing on the network. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
Is this the Supernatural Klingon episode? What is this going to be? And then it just turns out to go in, you know, go in and dig your own time crystals, State Park. I mean, it's like, okay.
Well, Larry, again, you know, you go in there and there's a like a basket type thing there, and you put in your 10 quatloos and you mm-hmm. get 60 minutes to dig your time crystal.
Dar-6. Yeah,
actually, the Klingons want Dar-6, don't they?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you go in, and actually, however many time crystals you can dig in 60 minutes, you get to keep. But the catch is, they're time crystals. So 60 minutes to one person is only a minute to someone else.
Literary Treks.
We have the conversation between Pike and the Starfleet Admiral Terrell. About the specifics of why they were kept out of the war. This is even before we're in a situation where they have no choice but to stay out of the war. They couldn't go back if they wanted to. By, you know, sort of setting up the milestones in the story for this is about when this is happening during season one. You know, that allows us to tell our own independent story within that, but yet also you'll always know where you are in the regular TV show.
Earl Grey.
That question about whether life exists, either yes, it does, because like enough time has elapsed and there's enough planets out there, or no, it doesn't, because we are that race.
Oh.
That seeds life elsewhere in the universe.
The other answer is it did, but they all destroyed themselves, you know. But that's also kind of unlikely that you'd have lots of civilizations all doing the same thing and destroying themselves, I think. But
to the journey!
And the seven
that's
of
all I could think about with that
this
one.
This is the Seinfeld in space episode.
I keep waiting for Elaine to show up.
I'm trying to think of what Jerry Seinfeld would say in Jerry Seinfeld's tone of voice inside this episode. Can you do a good Jerry Seinfeld?
Oh, good grief, no. Not even close.
I'm trying to think how I would approach doing a Jerry Seinfeld impersonation. It's not coming to me. He's got that super high-pitched da-da-da-da-da kind of, I don't know, kind
yeah.
of voice.
Well, that you did really well, the da-da-da-da-da. So, yeah, there you go.
Why don't they just warp out of here?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they are published. And please leave us a star rating and written review.
If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, YouTube, Windows Phone, in most third-party apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link.
We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to do that. The best place to join the larger conversation is the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and select The Edge. That will come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. So, Amy, where can people find you when you're not threatening your kids with a nuclear holocaust of the Earth?
Well, when I'm not doing that, which is every day, you can find me here on the network where I'm co-hosting Earl Grey about Star Trek Next Generation. You can find me on Twitter at Miss Amy Nelson. And I am right there in the Babel Conference listening to your comments and talking to you. So, Patrick, where can people reach you when you are not counting to two to get me to do what you want?
Well, when I'm not doing that, but you pretty much do good. But when that's not happening, You can find me on the Babel Conference. I pop in and out of there as often as I can. My teacher schedule is about to get crazy. So, you know, weekends. And you can also find me for a little while longer. You can find me on Warp 5, where there's some really special episodes coming with me and Brandon, my good friend. And soon you'll be able to find me at, and I haven't announced this on the Edge yet, you'll be able to find me on the United Federation of Planets with a new podcast with one of our associate producers, Chris Tribuzio, where we will be covering Marvel movies, Disney movies, Star Wars movies, and anything under the Disney umbrella. And the name of that podcast will be Mickey's Marvels.
Huh. Now, is that United Federation of Podcasts?
Did I say planets?
Yes, you did.
Eh, I'm on a Star Trek podcast. Yeah, so yeah. It is the United Federation of Podcasts.
Very exciting. So anything like Disney umbrella, I did not.
Every single thing Disney did. Now, what we won't be doing is things Disney just owns. So, for instance, Star Trek 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, they had nothing to do with the creation of those movies. We will not be covering them. They did, however, create the movies since 6, or really since 3, but so we will be covering those movies.
Wait, Disney and Star Trek?
Star Wars.
Oh, Star Wars.
Star Wars. Episode 1 through 6 was done by Lucasfilms.
Yes.
So, and they were not a tie. They were tied to Disney through the parks, but not the movies. Yeah. Right. So there are scenes of the movies in the parks, but the movies were not made with Disney as a distributor, as a producer, as anything.
Right.
We will cover all Pixar, even though Disney didn't own it, say, during Toy Story 2. They were the distributor of Toy Story 2, so they technically have a piece of it, so we can cover it. Star Wars Episode 7, they produced, directed, you know, they were the production house for, so we will cover it. We will not be going back to Iron Man 1, even though they literally owned Marvel for every other Marvel Universe movie.
I think you're just making these rules up as you go along.
No, it's a simple rule. If Disney owned it at the time, we'll cover it.
Got it.
They had to own the means of production or distribution.
Okay.
Then we will cover it. And cartoons. We'll do cartoons. We'll do parks once in a while. We're going to do anything they own.
Okay. Sounds good. Well, if you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more, available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm.
We'd also like to thank our loyal houses, our associate producers, Norman C. Lau, Tony Robinson, Thomas Puleo, Lisa Slack, Shoaib Mirza, Richard Rutledge, James Muldrow, Cornelia Reutner, Ryan Millett, Chris Tribuzio, and Brian Malosh. Thank you for supporting Trek FM and The Edge in particular.
Thank you for listening, and join us next time to see what's happening on The Edge. Wait for it. A Federation Space.